welcome to One More Thing Before You Go, a unique conversation about life with your host, Michael R. Hurst, a weekly dialogue about how you can manage the things that we methodically push down deep inside ourselves, the stuff we whisper about and hide from, and where you may get to say that one more thing before somebody walks out the door or to those you lost or are losing. We are happy you're here. Come on in and join the conversation. Here's Michael.
In today's program, we have the pleasure of talking to Amy Carlson, who is known as the Toxin Terminator and the podcast host of the same name. This is where she believes in restoring and renewing your health by getting rid of hidden toxins. I will share how to connect with Amy and how to listen to her podcast at the end of the program and provide a link in the episode notes. In this week's episode, that thing about losing a parent at a young age and how it affects our whole life, Amy's going to share her journey with losing her mother when she was only 10 years old, as well as three other family members within close proximity to each other. Welcome to the show, Amy, and thank you for being here. I appreciate you sharing your journey of loss and overcoming with us.
Oh, absolutely. I'm honored to be here and be able to provide some people with some hope.
Well, if you got a moment, please, can you tell us a little bit about Amy the person?
Amy the woman, the myth, the legend. No, I'm just kidding. I'm 54. I'm supposed to be retired, and I have later in life found a new passion. I was a owner and operator of Jiffy Lube franchises for better than 30 years of my life. So I am certified to work on cars. I had 5 locations in Council Bluffs in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm married to a wonderful man that is absolutely my better half. And he has 2 sons. I have a son. Collectively, we have 3. We've been married for 15 years, and we have 12 grandkids that just keep us young and energized.
12 grandkids is good. 12 grandkids is good. Well, again, welcome.
I appreciate you joining us
and sharing your stories. You lost 3 members of your family at a very young age.
I
know you lost your mother, your grandmother, and your grandfather all within a relatively short period of time. And then later on, you lost your brother. Mm-hmm. So can you, who did you lose first? And then how old were you when you lost them?
Sure. So my grandfather died first on my dad's side. And that was we don't have to give ages. I guess I did already with you. So, I would have been about 8 years old, just between 8 and 9 years old. And then not even 2 years later, I lost my mom, and I had just turned 10 when she passed away. And then within 6 months of her passing away, I believe, if I have my dates correctly, my grandmother on my mom's side passed away. And I came to find out later in life, you know, as a child, there's a lot of backstory that we don't always know going on. And what I found out is that my grandmother had been fighting multiple sclerosis for many, many years. And after my mom passed away, the desire to fight kind of left her. And that's why she passed so quickly.
So when your mother passed away, your grandfather, did he die of? Was it natural causes, or was something disease related, or something that you just were unaware of or not know as a child?
Yep. He had lung cancer, and he was in the Navy for many years and then also worked in the railroad industry. You know, today we know that, you know, leads to asbestos is a major exposure in the Navy and the shipyards and in the railroad industry. So obviously that's where that came from, because he died in his early 50s.
Did you know that as a child? Were you aware of what his history was and why he died?
I knew he had cancer, but I didn't know all the rest of the history in it. And it's important to know that, because when my mom was diagnosed and went into the hospital and we were told that she had cancer, obviously I can't remember how my siblings responded, but that scared me because I had, you know, grandpa just died of cancer. And we were told, my dad told me that, oh, you know, mom's cancer is not like that. It's not the same. She's going to be okay. I remember being told that.
When you were 10 years old, when your mother died, you were aware that she did have cancer?
I was aware that she had cancer as well.
I guess your dad took your mom to the hospital and he didn't come home with her. That's kind of how you knew she had passed on.
Well, she went into the hospital in November and she had a surgery. I mean, we didn't go visit her at the hospital. They brought her home for Christmas. They brought a nurse home with her and she came home for Christmas and then we didn't see her again. And we knew that she was sick and that she had cancer, but we were, you know, my dad told us that it wasn't like grandpa's cancer and that she was going to be okay. And then, when I came down from waking up and saw all her belongings on the dining room table, I was, excited. I thought, oh, good, mom's home. And I went to go back into their bedroom. And I'm like, where's mom? Where's mom? And dad was sitting and said, you need to come sit down and we need to have a conversation. So.
And I'm assuming you were close with your mother.
Yeah, I was.
We've got two daughters and both of our daughters are extremely close to their mother and like a best friend or an older sister, mm-hmm. actually. So this was a devastating blow to you?
Yeah, it was huge. And I think, I never got to experience that part of a mother-daughter relationship. You know, at that time at 10 years old, Mom was still superwoman. She was amazing. She could do all things and do nothing wrong. And she was a stay-at-home mom. She gardened, she sewed, she played piano, she led Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and volunteered at the school and, did all those things. A lot of the moms in the neighborhood I grew up in were stay-at-home moms. And so, I knew her as that. I didn't get the chance to know her as a woman and have a friendship with her.
So in regard to that, how did you feel about not being able to say goodbye?
Oh, it haunted me. It really did. There were many things that haunted me. Growing up, I didn't get a chance to grieve. She passed it. It was a Sunday morning that she died. And we went to school on Monday. We were taken out of school for her funeral on a Wednesday and went right back into school on Thursday. And then it was just never talked about again. And so, my world just got rocked and I had no one to talk to about that. So, that was really hard for me. Now I can't remember your original question.
We were talking about the aspects of not being able to say goodbye.
Yeah. So yeah. I remember asking my dad at one point, and I don't remember how old I was, but I just asked, what were mom's last words? Because he spent all kinds of time with her. He was always up at the hospital. And I had asked that question and I was always told, when you're old enough, I'll share that with you. When you're old enough, I'll talk to you about that. So I grew up with this fantasy that there was something so profound shared at her end of life and that, I was certain it had something to do with me, right? And I was so looking forward to this time of finding this out. And later on in life, I was probably in my late 20s, early 30s. I reconnected with my aunt, my mom's sister. And because after she passed, the family just didn't get together. And I remember asking Mary Jo, I was never told what mom's last words were. And I was always told when I got old enough that it would be shared with me and dad never talks about it. Do you know what mom's final words were. And she looked at me and she said, Amy, your mom was in a coma for weeks before she passed away. There were no last words. I'm like, oh, you're killing me. You know, it was just like, what? You know, so, you know, as a child, we fantasize so much and we, I carried through childhood into adulthood. Well, you need to understand that I look exactly like my mom. I was told that by everybody. You are the epitome of your mother. You look exactly like her. You act like her, you know, and even today when you look at pictures, there's no denying, you know, we're mother daughter. And so I got told that repeatedly over and over again. And so I felt like I'm going to die when I'm 32 years old. You know, she was 32 years old when she passed away. So I was convinced, you know, these childlike things that we implant into our head.
So it's a profound effect on you, actually, from the age of 10 forward, because obviously it affected you for a good portion. Well, a good portion of your early life.
Absolutely.
Obviously, you overcame.
Absolutely.
You know, eventually, you came to overcome that. Maybe in a little bit, we'll kind of expand upon that.
Sure.
Because we know, as a child, most kids done in young people, they don't get to understand what grieving is. They don't understand what the five stages of grieving are. In my old profession as a police officer, I ran into a lot of kids that used to get into trouble for a lot of stuff. And then you do a little more investigation and find out that basically they lost a parent.
Right.
And they didn't know why. Nobody would tell them. They didn't understand it. They didn't know how to deal with their feelings. They didn't know what to do with them. So that's where they ended up. And, and unfortunately, at least back in Colorado, where I was a police officer, in the area that I was a police officer, there was a lot of kids that got in trouble, and a good portion of them were due to something like losing a parent. Mm-hmm. Some got help, some did not. And I continued to deal with them up until the time I retired, and then my colleagues dealt with them afterwards. Mm-hmm. So they continued down a nasty path of, I don't want to say acting out, but trying to cope with what they were not allowed to cope with at an early age because they lost a parent.
Yeah. As I grew up, stop me if you not want me to talk about this now, but what I knew when I was growing up was that I hurt. I don't know that I could put a label on how I felt inside, but there was this huge hole that I just didn't feel good. I didn't like my reality. You know, lost my mom. My dad remarried very quickly. And then he fell into alcoholism and was gone a lot, wasn't a lot of big presence in our life. And, you know, and then I found alcohol and drugs as well because it numbed the pain. I didn't have to feel what I was feeling when I was under the influence of alcohol or drugs. And then that led to obviously horrible behaviors. But the beauty about it is, I got sober when I was still only 19 years old or 20, you know, maybe I was 20 years old when I got sober. And, you know, God just has a hand in our lives all along. And when I got sober, at the time when I did, there were treatment centers that you went away to for a long period of time. And the nurse that was in the treatment center that took care of me was the same nurse that took care of my mom when she was in the hospital.
Oh, that's ironic.
Mm-hmm.
That's ironic.
So,
I was going to ask you how did it complicate your teenage years? Until that time, were you always, did you turn it to alcohol at an early age within your teenage years, or did that come a little bit later?
Early. I'm trying to think. It was the summer between 7th and 8th grade that I took my first drink. So how old would that be?
12, 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So 12, 13 years old would put you in there.
Yep.
Which again, as my statements earlier, in dealing with individuals, young people that I met on the street that we were picking up, a lot of it was alcohol. mm-hmm. and drugs mm-hmm. at that age. And they were trying to use it as a coping mechanism to help them get through what they were doing. So,
yep, I can relate. I can relate.
So you stopped, you went to treatment. Did you mm-hmm. do that on your own? Or is that something that somebody helps you get into?
So my entire family kind of got sober around the same time, within about 12 months of each other. So at that time, when a family member was in treatment, you as a family member had to go to what they considered family treatment. And so each person had to go through their own individual thing, because you had to talk about how their using affected you and your life. And it was aside and separate from the person who was receiving treatment. And so it was an 8-week program, and you had to sign a contract that you weren't going to use any mind or mood altering, substances. And I couldn't make it through the treatment. I got busted coming drunk. I actually came to a session drunk. So and I went. So that was the end of that one.
Well, it that answers the question of whether or not, how did it affect the whole family?
Yeah.
For losing people. So the loss of those individuals affected your family as a whole.
Yeah.
And continued to affect your family as a whole.
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
After you got out of the last rehab where you boo-booed a little bit, did you find more help? Or what are the kind of coping mechanisms were you able to discover?
So going through that, it took me 48 days to get through a 30-day treatment program. So I'm a little bit of a slow learner. However, in the process, a couple of things. Having the nurse there, Joanne Weber was her name. I'll always remember her. Many, many great conversations with her. One of my biggest things that I hadn't dealt with was the death of my mother and grieving. So that was heavily dealt with me in treatment and walking through grief. So I was, 19, 20 years old, almost 10 years later, now experiencing all that raw emotion of letting go, walking through that grief, and huge strides in becoming more aware of how I feel and what I did. And then from there, I went to AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I met some amazing women that loved me until I could love myself, and nurtured me and walked me through and taught me how to live a sober life. And that's what I did. And you have to have that in your life. If you don't want to drink anymore, you cannot be around people who are drinking. You need to get with people who are going to encourage you to do all the right things. And drinking and drugging, I don't care what choice of substance you use, that's simply a symptom. That's simply the coping mechanism you use. There's so much underlying, and it took years of work individually inside to get to a place where I felt peaceful and at peace and good about who I was. And even into, 10 years ago, that's always modifying and changing and morphing. But, learning to live life on life's terms, accepting life how it is. And we're not promised an easy life. You know that, Michael. There was just something in my brain that thought that life should be different, so that's what I did. I chose to go the AA route.
And
I still go.
And you still go. Well, that's a positive thing. Congratulations on that. Kudos to anybody that can stick with the program and stay with the program and continue the program. As I said earlier in actually one of my introductions, my father died. He was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And that's why he died of esophageal cancer and cirrhosis of the liver, both. And he was 39 years old.
Boy.
It's both my parents were alcoholics, actually. Not to get into long story, but both my parents were alcoholics. And both of them, I think, used alcohol to cope with the atmosphere and the environment that they grew up in.
Right.
You know, we didn't know till years and years later on both of them, actually, that of what was transpiring in their home environment, that was a big secret and it was kept secret and so forth. And just recently, within the last probably 5 or 6 years, it finally came out. And that was their coping mechanism. That's how they escaped and that's how they got through things. But I appreciate and I give kudos to anybody that sticks with the program. I arrested a lot of drunk drivers. I was the sergeant in charge of a DUI task force, and I did it as a choice. And some people, it was a mistake. Some people, it was a problem. So anybody that stays in a program is a good thing.
Absolutely.
Not to change the subject too quickly. When did you lose your brother? Like, how old, I don't want to really get into ages, but how long after all of this you lost your brother? Because you were kind of close to your brother, were you not?
I was very close to my brother.
In that case, please tell me about your brother.
My brother was born with an immune deficiency. And so, and we're not quite 2 years apart. He was older than I was. And there are many points in his life that he was sick, especially when he was younger, before they came upon a treatment that would help him. And we worked together in our family business. He and I worked together. You know, we bonded so closely together after losing mom. We were, because dad wasn't there either. You know, he was active in his stuff. And so Jim and I were the ones who, like, really grabbed hands and really got even closer at that time. And he passed away just 10 years, it'll be 12 years this summer that he's been gone. And so he lived with my husband and I the last couple years of his life. And we both took care of him.
Well, and if you can help our audience understand a little bit, how was it different losing your brother and then losing your grandparents or your mother?
Oh, night and day. I mean, both losses hurt. And I think my brother's loss was probably more devastating to me than the other three, because of the closeness of our relationship. And he just was somebody I looked up to. It's somebody I, you know, he walked through so much with me in my life, and I got to talk. You know, there was not anything unsaid between he and I. We spent so much time together, and I got to hear his regrets. I got to hear his, you know, wants and desires. I got to hear lots of things, you know, from him. And so I appreciate, you know, having that time with him.
Yeah, it's very important. People don't realize the opportunity to say goodbye or say, something, one last thing before they go, which is the whole purpose of this podcast, which is extremely, I won't say gratifying, but it gives you a better sense of peace and a better sense of understanding when they leave. You got to say what you wanted to say, do, you know, kind of what you wanted to do to a certain point. And it's different than losing somebody abruptly. Because you're left with a void when you lose somebody abruptly, or you don't know much about it, or you don't get to say goodbye, or you don't get to say what you want to say. So in taking care of your brother, I think that was a benefit, at least from my perspective, and watching both sides of it, both through family, friends, and colleagues, and strangers.
Yeah,
that's a very positive thing.
Yeah.
So
they both have their challenges, you know, for sure. I don't know that one is easier, better. I mean, loss is loss, but because there was so much I didn't get to say and learn and know about my mom, you know, in growing up, but I got to do that, you know, when I went through my treatment, I got to do that when I was going through my counseling, because I wrote letters and I buried them at her graveside, you know, so I would sit and say all the things that I needed to say. And I found answers and talked to people that knew her and were close to her. So there are, you know, for me,
That's a very efficient counselor. That's an extremely positive thing to do, to write down what you wanted to say when you didn't get the opportunity to, and write the letter to somebody like that, and to tell them what you wanted to say. The bearing with them is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I had to do that with a friend of mine, one of my best friends. He actually was another law enforcement officer, and we lost him in 2010. Mm-hmm. And we were very close. He was my kid's godfather. And so my kids wrote him a letter, and I took it with me to his funeral, and they put it in his casket with him. And mm-hmm. that helped them get a little bit of closure, mm-hmm. because they got to say to Uncle John what they wanted to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a positive thing.
Yep.
Tell me about your experience in being a caretaker for your brother. Do you think that was that a better option in your case that allowed you to do this? Because I know sometimes caretakers get focused, and they kind of lose track of themselves, and they become more of a caretaker from a clinical perspective than a personal perspective.
So can I identify with that statement? When the last couple of years of my brother's life, there was always many hospital stays, but one particular one, usually it was just me with him. I was told that he wasn't going to live through this hospital stay, so I was calling the family in. And when my parents arrived, they went past the room. They didn't recognize me. You know, and my mom said that to me, you know, later, you know, I didn't recognize you, and you get lost. You get lost in taking care of them. You get lost in time. That was one of the big things after losing him, that I didn't realize how much of time I spent with him. You know, if it wasn't physically with him, taking care of him, then it was thinking about him, thinking about, you know, am I doing all the things I need to do to give him the best quality of life that he can possibly have? Am I, you know, providing as much as I can provide for him? Am I giving him all the opportunities that I can give him? And then in my own mind, I'm also thinking about, what am I going to do when he's gone? You know, I knew the end was coming. And so I was already starting to grieve and go through those processes before he even left. And that really sucked the air out of me after he passed away, that time thing. And trying to figure out how to fill that void back up again, right? You know, we get those empty voids that we have to figure out a positive way to have them filled. But yeah, it just, I loved it because there's so many memories, you know, that I have that many of my other family members don't have. You know, that I can laugh about now and I can giggle about. And it took me a couple of years to get to that point where I could laugh, you know, and it took me a couple of years to get past the real sick part, you know, to get past and look and get to the healthier parts and get to the good memories, not all the tragedy, right? All the bad stuff.
Yeah, and taking care of somebody for the last 18 months of their life. My father-in-law had Lewy body dementia, so I can understand exactly where you're coming from. And it's different, you know, when you participate in someone's end of life that way.
Yeah.
And we, you know, my wife and I did the same thing. We got very clinical. At times we kind of forgot to take care of ourselves, and we forgot how to be a couple. Mm-hmm. We forgot how to be individual as well. And it was a 24/7 job. So I respect you for doing that. And I respect other people that do it too. They're just people. I think a reminder that we could express upon anybody that's in that situation or going to go through that situation is, keep in mind that you are a person Mm-hmm. You're a family member, you're a friend, or a spouse, or whoever you happen to be, that you need to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
And make sure that you continue to take care of yourself, because if you get sick, then you're of no benefit to that individual.
Yep.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And learning to accept the help. When the help is there, take the help. You know, my husband and I did a lot of tag teaming. My brother didn't want to die in the hospital. He spent so many times in the hospital. That's not where he wanted to die. And I wanted to honor that. And I had to fight for that. He fell and broke his hip just a week before he passed. And first of all, I felt a lot of guilt for that because that was on my watch. You know, it was, you know, in my care. But secondly, there was nothing they could do. I mean, we were already at a point where there was nothing they could do, but they couldn't even do surgery, you know, nothing. So we literally watched him lay there and pass away. And I can't remember what I was going at with that, but must not have been that important. I got kind of lost, but it's Yeah, when we went to the hospital to find out that his hip was broken, they wanted to keep him there, and they wanted, or move him to a hospice facility. And I had to fight with, he does not want to be there. That's not what his desire is. And at this point, he was like a dementia patient. He didn't know reality, you know, what was real and what wasn't. And, yeah. So I made the decision to bring him back home and set things up and have that there. And then my whole family was there with us. So it was actually one of those experiences that really brought the family closer together as a whole unit. Even though it's death, we were all able to be there. We were all able to support each other, and we were all able to see, myself, my sister, and my dad were able to see those last final minutes that he shared so much with us in, that made such an impactful difference in my life and my dad's life and my sister's life to be able to see that.
Well, that's, I think it's important. It's important from several different perspectives. Our daughter, I keep saying my daughter, but it's actually our daughter. Our daughter moved in with Diane and I, so mm-hmm. that she could help us take care of her grandfather. So mm-hmm. it was a profound experience for her as well. Mm-hmm. She saw life from a different perspective in that regard, but she didn't shy away from it. So, which we love her for. We have two daughters. The other daughter was working in California, so she wasn't able to make it out here, but she did come out to say what she wanted to say prior to him going, because we had him here in the house as well. So we had hospice come in here. Mm-hmm. Close to the time that he was going to pass. And my wife was extremely grateful for the fact that we were able to get him and keep him in the house.
Yep.
With hospice coming here, because it gave her an opportunity to reconnect with her father over at least 18 months that he had left, because prior to that, they had a relationship, but it really wasn't a close relationship. This changed it a little mm-hmm. bit, so she at least had a better opportunity to connect with him on a different level.
Absolutely. Which was good.
We had some fun times, and he laughed a lot. And mm-hmm. With his dementia, he used to, we'd hear him giggling and laughing, and we'd come up and he'd say, what are you laughing at? And he said, well, the squirrel's chasing the chipmunk. And he'd go, see there, it's going right up my arm and running down over there, and don't you see it? He'd point to the chipmunk or the squirrel he was seeing, you know, so we kind of play along a little bit. But it gave her an opportunity for some positive memories too, and so forth. And we get to say goodbye.
And that's what you have to choose. I mean, once you're beyond that point, in the beginning, it was hard. Like I said, it was hard for me to get past the devastating parts, right? It was hard to every time he went to sleep, it's like a brain reset. And he'd wake up and he'd start saying, Amy, my body feels different. I know I'm catching something. We need to go to the doctor. And I'd have to say, no, Jim, we're not going to the doctor anymore. And, he'd say, well, am I just supposed to lay here and die? And it's like, Jim, that's where we are right now. And seeing that realization in his eyes. And in every single time it was, it wasn't faked. He was like hitting him, but choosing to not go there anymore. I choose to go to the funny. We went to the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. A whole airplane ride was it was just so interesting. I lost him in the airport. It was just like, how did I lose him? But I did. And he had to go to the bathroom. And so he gets into the restroom before we're taken off, right? We're on the tarmac and he's not coming out and we can't back away from the gate and we're blocking up all kinds of air traffic. And everybody's like, they're like, can't you get out? I'm like, I can't get him out of there. I'm sorry. So it's just like, there were so many things that were so funny, and experiences that happened. He overfilled he flooded the bathtub in the room that we were staying in because he had stepped on the, how the bathtubs have you step on the plug. Yeah, the plug. He had stepped on it and didn't know when he was taking the shower. And he's like, is there something wrong? And I go in the bathroom and it's flooding. And, it's just like, and I come back out and he's standing there and he's like, just something's not right. And I'm like, no, you're right, Jim. Something's not right. He's got both legs in one pant leg. He's can't figure out why he can't walk, but he was so good hearted about it. He'd giggle and it just, so I like to go back. That was even in the final time, but we had, even in there, we had some good laughs and good memories. And, I like to go back to those points. And I know that he'd want me to remember him that way.
And that's a positive thing. I think everybody should, in this particular situation, remember to look back on the fun times, the laughs, mm-hmm. and the funny moments, and keep that in your heart because, this way, this individual lives on in your heart. And always.
Well, and in a good way, when we focus on the hurt and the pain and the suffering for them, for us, as we're gone, that's the energy you're going to create. That's what you're going to have in your life. And you'll always feel lost and you'll always feel void and you'll always have that negativity. And if you choose to look at, you're going to see them again. It's not the end, you had good memories that they're in your heart, that's what you got to focus on, not the hurt and the pain.
Well, that's the next question, I guess, would be spiritual aspects and life after death. So how do you feel about life after death? Do you think when somebody passes that there is life beyond mm-hmm. in some form or another?
I absolutely do. And I was raised in the church. My grandfather was a Methodist minister. And I mean, we were raised in the church, but after mom died, we stopped going. And after, those deaths in my life and things getting so different, I didn't understand God. I didn't understand how you could allow these kinds of things to happen. How could you let this hurt and pain, come into my life if you're supposed to be such a good, God? And then later in life, and even getting into AA, I used the group as my, higher power and my God. I was still mad at him. I still didn't, have a good relationship with God yet. But I got back there later in life and through my brother's death. When he was really sick, mom would come visit him and he would share that, with me. And he'd always say, I must've really been sick this time because mom was here again. And I don't know if they talked or she just would have, I don't know how that manifested for him. But in his dying time, he told us that mom was there and then he was sharing that his third sister was there. And my sister and I were really confused because there was three of us. There was my brother was the oldest, me, and then my sister. And we were talking outside about it, and we were asking Dad, you know, he heard about it and he turned super white, like white as a ghost. We're like, "What, Dad, what's going on?" And he says, "You know, Amy, your mom had a miscarriage in between you two girls, and we never told anybody about it." And so he kept referring to his third sister, and as he was passing, you know, he shared with us that she was there. You know, he would say, "I can see her, but she's far away." And when he did die, you know, he said, "She's here." And we told him to go take her hand, and she would take him. And that's what happened. And that to me was wiped away any question, any doubt, any feeling like there's no afterlife, there's no heaven, because I still had my questions. You know, eternity, life forever. Our earthly brains can't even wrap around that. And experiencing that with him just took away any kind of doubt.
Yeah, when people, I mean, life after death is kind of a touchy subject to a lot of people, but in my experiences, I have heard strangers talking to somebody that wasn't there before they had passed on. I've heard family members talking to other family members that had passed on previously. And there were times some of the other family said, "Well, he's just, are just babbling." And they called it babble. And they said, "That's what happens, you know." And of course, I'm referring to the older generation. They were saying he just babbles, or they were just babbling. But the longer that I had witnessed it, the more I had seen it, the more I felt that somebody was actually talking to somebody on the other side, and they were there waiting for them so that they could help escort them.
I believe it 100%. And you know, I mean, this doesn't it does have stuff to do with death, but I think the older we get, the more jaded we get, the more, you know, we think, "Well, this isn't real." If you watch babies and you watch animals, I believe with everything in me that there are angels all around us. There are angels everywhere. And I think babies see them. And I think animals see them. And I think we as adults get told, "Well, that's not possible. This is, you know," and we just get so jaded in our mind that we take that ability away from us to be able to see them.
You lose the vision. You lose the vision. And I understand that. I agree with you 100%. I think that there are angels that take care of us, look over our shoulder. And in my career and in my life, I know and I can attest to the fact that I had several angels looking over my shoulder at specific times. And I'm still here. So because of that, so I do believe that. You know, David, my father-in-law, I guess the most experience I had to that was when David was here, because, you know, we had been with him so close, 24/7. And the fact that David was not a religious individual. He grew up in the church as a child, but then he walked away from the church for the longest time. And, you know, his vision was that you just go to a black space, you know, go anywhere when you pass on. And that was his thought. He didn't want last rites. He didn't want a priest, preacher. He didn't want anybody here to give him any kind of last rites or anything like that. His sisters kind of disagreed, but it's something he didn't want. So we kind of left it that way. So there was a few times we caught him. Well, I won't say caught him, because that sounds like you do something wrong.
That's the cop coming out in you.
I got to keep remembering that. Basically, we found him talking, talking to somebody, and then we'd kind of peek around the corner and we'd listen in a little bit. And he was actually talking to his grandparents, his grandfather in specific, who he was extremely close to, and his aunt. And I have to ask my wife next time we talk, because he was talking to three different people. And these were three different people that had passed on quite some time ago, but he was very close to, and he was just having a conversation. And this was probably about a week before he actually passed on. And we asked him, "Who are you talking to?" And he says, "Oh, I'm just talking to Mac and, you know, Mary and so forth." And we go, "Okay." And went about our business and he laid back down and went to sleep.
I just think my brother was a very faithful man and, very spiritual, had a very, very close, relationship. So, he shared with me, I'm not afraid to die. I know exactly where I'm going. And I believe that 100%. His anxiety, if you will, was the process to get there. He knew it was going to be hard. He knew, the walk, but he also knew that, God hasn't taken me yet. There's something I haven't fulfilled. There's some purpose I haven't done that he created me for. And I believe it was the end. I believe my sister, my dad, and I needed to see what we saw and witness what we saw so that we could share that later.
With people, yeah, that's a good thing. I think it's a positive thing. What would you recommend for people who have lost somebody at a young age after all of your experiences and what you went through and your challenges as you grew up and through adulthood? What would you recommend for somebody that is losing or has lost somebody?
Number one, talk. Grief looks different for everybody, and everybody processes grief in a different way. And don't let anybody tell you that you're handling grief wrong, because you need to walk through that grief process in your own way. My dad handled grief very differently than I did. And he would many times say to me, you're not handling it. And I have a lot of family that won't talk to me about my brother because they say to me, you cry every time we talk about him. And I'm like, but they're not bad tears. It's okay. It's okay to talk about the deceased person. It's okay. And sometimes we who are mourning that deceased person, we need to hear about them. We need to be talking about them. I'm not sure when you can identify that your actions and behaviors are not healthy or appropriate, other than are they affecting your life style? Are they affecting those around you in a negative way? And then I think you need to look at it. And I would encourage everybody, especially young ones, please, if you're a parent, take your children into counseling. Let them get professional help, because especially as a parent, sometimes we as little kids, we don't feel comfortable sharing a lot with our parents. We don't feel comfortable telling them the truth because we don't want to hurt our parents. We don't want them to be more sad. We don't want, to create more whatever in their life. So, seek out that professional help by all means, no matter what age you are, but especially as kids, younger kids and teens, get them in to talking with somebody so that they can work through it in a healthy way so that it doesn't affect their lives. They don't have to go through making, really poor choices or live their life with that huge void and hole, and know that, life can still be good.
That's very good advice. I agree with you 100%. Communication is important. People have lost the art of communication, especially in today's technology age with texting and artificial intelligence and everything else handling everything.
Yeah.
People are losing the ability to talk and to communicate through voice one-on-one.
Yeah.
So that's important. And be open to listening. So when you do talk to somebody, or if you do express what you're feeling and so forth, the other individual needs to be able to listen.
Right.
And be open to listening with an open mind and not a closed mind, and think thoroughly. Don't shut something down because you think that it's not right. And don't shut it down because you think that it's not the right answer, because there's always an answer somewhere, and that they should work through it together if necessary.
Yeah. Well, feelings are feelings. Feelings are neither right nor wrong. Feelings are feelings. And understanding that and letting somebody have their feelings, and you got to walk through them. You can't avoid them. They are going to come back and bite you in the ass in a major way if you don't feel them. You've got to walk into that grief. You've got to feel the pain because you get to get on the other side of it and see the beauty of what you had. And if you don't feel those feelings, you're always going to be in that pain and void.
Well, and realistically, there are numerous ways to deal with your pain and your grief artistically as well through creative arts therapy. So very good programs in dealing with music and dealing with art, painting, and sculpting, and dance, and drama. Creative arts therapy is a very effective way of helping you work through your grief, work through your issues with losing someone. Or I don't know if I want to use the word issues, working through the process of dealing with loss to at least do it from a positive perspective. And who knows, you may realize you're a great artist.
Yeah.
Or a great dancer, or a great singer, or a great drum player.
You don't know, or a writer, or, you know, there's so many different creativities and group. You know, there are so many different grief groups. There's many, many churches that have grief groups, and you don't even have to belong to the church to come through that. There are so many different processes. You know, when I was younger, and then with my nieces and nephews, when my brother passed, I took them to, was it called Amanda the Panda? It was for kids. It was a weekend like thing, but you could connect with the people there. And that connection, we need community. We need that connection. So when we can communicate with and be connected to people who have walked in our shoes, then it's much easier for us to get through that, you know, with them.
I agree 100%. Is there anything else that you feel that is important to pass on?
You know, knowing that God doesn't take us through things that he can't get us, you know, he doesn't walk us into anything he can't get us through, and that, you know, he is our strength. He is our peace and comfort. And he is there, whether we believe it or not. He is there with us. He is walking with us. You know, he is my strength, and he is who I turn to in my times of trouble, and even in my times of joy, and in my time, you know, everything I owe, you know, to him. You know, he has blessed me immensely.
Well, Amy, I appreciate your conversation today. Thank you very much for all the tips and for the advice and for your stories. I think that sharing what you have shared with us should help people move through their process.
I hope
especially
so.
If they're, you know, have an experience at a young age and or have children that are going through that experience. It gives them at least somewhat of a path to understanding and knowing that there are answers out there, and that don't give up, just choose the right path and to make sure that you can heal correctly and stay positive about the experience. One last thing, Amy, my thoughts are that negativity, anger, grief, resentment over losing somebody are toxic to our system, and that there are ways to alleviate that. Do you agree?
So in order to have a toxin-free lifestyle, there's five pillars of living a toxin-free lifestyle. They're air, water, food, absorption, and mental. So grief is part of that mental part, right? We have grief, we have stress, we have mental illness, whether it's anxiety, depression. There are so many realms of mental, and I believe it's one of the stronger pillars of really getting to the bottom of removing toxins from our home and our environment.
I agree 100%. Again, thank you very much, Amy. I really appreciate your time and sharing everything with us. You can find The Toxin Terminator on your favorite podcast platforms or in the link in the show notes.
Oh, absolutely. I'm honored to be able to provide some people with some hope.
For our listeners out there, please remember that if you're experiencing any of these issues or if you need help yourself, there are support groups that are available to you as well as crisis lines. Please keep in mind that you need to communicate, talk to your family, talk to your friends, talk to your colleagues. You are not alone. I'll provide information in the show notes of several options for getting help if you're experiencing any of these things. This is your host, Michael R. Hurst, signing off for this week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of One More Thing Before You Go, a unique conversation about life. If you like our show and want to know more, check out our website at beforeyougopodcast.com. That's beforeyougopodcast.com. Tell your story, share your expertise, contribute to the blog, and subscribe to the newsletter. You can find us as well as subscribe to the program and rate us on your favorite podcast listening platform.
And one more thing before you go, have a nice day, have a nice week, and thanks for listening.
One More Thing Before You Go, a Unique Conversation About Life podcast, is a creation of One More Thing Productions, established 2010, all rights reserved.